Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Here's a promise. No other radio show on the planet will take you to the places we're sending you today. We open with squiggonometry. Then you'll learn about confusing fall warblers. At 10, you'll hear about the Inflation Reduction Act, and we'll finish at a mattress recycling center. By the end of the show, you'll have amazing fodder for the next happy hour or dinner party you attend. And let's get started with, yes, squiggonometry. And yes, I have been seduced by the amazing name, but I'm also a sucker to learn about the practical applications that math has. Joining me now to discuss this is Rob Pudiak, the chair of the mathematics department at Norwich University. Professor Pudiak, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks so much for having me on, Rick.
Oh, it's great having you. Listeners, I can't wait for the first call to chat about squiggonometry with our guest. You can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Rob, I'm guessing that squiggonometry is not the intersection of geometry with Squiggy of the old Laverne and Shirley TV show. So what exactly is squiggonometry?
No, in the first case, that would be Lenny and squiggonometry.
Ah, yeah. You were ready for that one, weren't you?
I was, thank you.
Well done.
I'm here all morning. But squiggonometry, I think, listeners, of course, probably know from their school days, trigonometry.
Right.
Trigonometry, when we look at the trigonometric functions, they're often built inside of what's called the unit circle, a circle of radius 1 that's centered where the x-axis and the y-axis, vertical and horizontal axis, intersect. And the equation of that circle, x squared plus y squared equals 1, just means that any point x, y on that circle, if you square the first coordinate and you square the second coordinate and you add them together, you get 1. That has exponent 2, has a square on both things, but we can change the exponent. We can put in some absolute values and put in any exponent p bigger than or equal to 1. Well, if you graph that out, what you get is more and more squarish-looking curves, kind of a cross between a square and a circle, and so the looking at things related to that is squiggonometry.
So square and trigonometry, squares and trigonometry put together bring us squiggonometry.
Square circles.
Gotcha. Yeah. Now, or rectangles with curved edges, is that another way to look at it?
You could think of it that way. That would be the resemblance of it. And, in fact, many people listening to this or even driving around listening to this would know these type of rectangles or squircles because the icons on, for instance, an iPhone are actually squircles.
Oh, right. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are.
So,
okay.
So they do show up in a lot of different places, and you have various stadiums, for instance, around the world that have that sort of shape to it.
Sure. Well, is this a new field, or is this one that's been around for a while that just doesn't get a whole lot of notice by the non-mathematics set?
I think you could say probably the second one. You know, in trigonometry, you have the sine and the cosine functions, and as you go around the unit circle counterclockwise, the cosine and the sine are what are the names for the x and the y coordinates, and as you change the parameter value t, you go around counterclockwise. But mathematicians, probably since the 1800s at least, have been looking to take a different kind of curves and say, well, can we come up with things like the cosine and sine that and get two functions that will describe our journey along these curves. There have been articles that have come out at various intervals. In the 40s and 50s, there were a couple of mathematicians who looked at this sort of thing. So I guess I would say it comes and it goes.
Gotcha.
And a lot of non-mathematicians probably aren't aware of this, of squigonometric functions. And the name squigonometry came from my friend and colleague, Bill Wood, out in at the University of Northern Iowa. He wrote an article on these functions about 11 years ago or so that first got some extended attention.
Well, I'm kind of excited to be living in the new age of squigonometry and learning it from you, Rob. What got you interested in squigonometry in the first place?
About 20 years ago, I was, doing my due diligence like I'm supposed to as a mathematician, reading some journals. And there was this fascinating article in one of them involving pi. Now, I think a lot of us, of course, if we think of math, it goes, oh, pi, of course, is 3.1415, et cetera. A lot of us know that. Think of pi and say, oh, it's the ratio of the circumference to the diameter of a circle.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple of gentlemen wrote an article involving different ways to measure distance. And with these different measures, they said, well, pi would have a different value if we did this. And I just thought that was fascinating. If we tweak this little number here, pi gets this value. If we tweak it a little bit differently, it has a different value. So pi turned from being just this one number into a whole bunch of possible different numbers. And they described things on squircles. And so I just started playing around, and I thought it would be neat, and said, well, what if we had a version of the sine and cosine functions that could describe somebody walking around one of these unit squircles? And I struggled with it for a number of years, and then finally in 2011 I read Bill Wood's article on squigonometry, and a lot of things became clear to me. And then I was able to come up with sort of a follow-up to that probably about, I think it was 6 or 7 years ago, that article came out on some uses of squigonometry to find some areas and volumes.
Rob, you do realize that all those kids who have memorized pi to like 100 places are going to be cursing your name and all those involved in squigonometric studies.
one of the beauties of math is to take the things that we know and figure out, is this a thing on it just on its own, or is it a special case of some bigger class of things? And to me, at least, it was kind of stunning to figure out, well, pi, the pi we know, we love, that kids on Pi Day, March 14th, write digits in, down the hallway.
Right.
That it's a special case, of a whole class of numbers that actually describe something physical.
If you start messing with prime numbers, Rob, our deal is done. Our relationship is over. Now, can you give us an example of where squigonometry is used somewhere in everyday, our everyday world, unbeknownst to us? One you gave was the icons on our phones, but how about something else?
Sure. In fact, there's a slightly older example. There was this Danish philosopher and mathematician named Piet Hein. He lived from probably the early 1900s. I think he passed away in the mid-90s. But he was looking for a pleasing shape that was kind of halfway between a circle and a rectangle. And it was a thought experiment he came up with because the urban planners in Stockholm, Sweden, this was in the late 50s, were building a center square for Stockholm. And they wanted to have this sort of oval-shaped fountain in the middle of the square. And they were trying to figure out a way to shape it best to most efficiently flow traffic around it. And it wasn't a circle. It wasn't an ellipse. It turned out that the shape that worked out for them was going to be sort of a stretched out squircle. You could call it Hine called it a super ellipse, but it was kind of what we're working with an exponent of 2.5. And he just picked that because traffic flowed fine around the fountain in the middle of Stockholm. Hmm. It's a place called Sergels Torg, but also it was just visually pleasing to him. And so one of the things that can be done with squigonometry is, for instance, you can actually figure out what the area of that particular center square is. You know, the usual formulas for area involving circles or even ellipses don't come into play here. And so squigonometry can actually help us find the exact area of what that town, what that city square is going to be.
And Rob, this is probably a good time for you to explain the difference between a hyper ellipse or super ellipse and a super egg.
Sure. A hyper ellipse or super ellipse is simply a squircle that's not fully symmetric. It's stretched out, almost looking more like a rectangle and a circle rather than a square and a circle. A super egg is a kind of a 3D version of that. If you take a circle that we're used to and you sort of rotate it, the mental picture I'm having is one of those lanterns that you see, those paper lanterns that kind of start flat, but you can unfold them and they turn into an actual 3D object. Mm-hmm. If you take a circle and do that, you get a sphere. If you take a hyper ellipse or a super ellipse and you do that, you get a super egg. And the amazing part about a super egg is its center of gravity is low enough is that you can lay it on a tabletop, and unlike, say, a regular egg or something called an ellipsoid, it won't fall over. It will sit perfectly still on the table with absolutely no problem.
Mm. And the person who gets the gold star, he is our listener of the week, stepping forward with a question, is none other than Forbes in East Corinth. Forbes, thanks for calling.
How are you this morning?
Great.
With no offense to your guest, but out of 100 people, how many would actually utilize this program? Mm-hmm. I mean, the event.
Yeah. Rob, it's a great question. The one thing I like to talk about with math is its practicality and everyday usage. But how often is squigonometry used, either known or unbeknownst to those who are using it?
To be fair, Forbes is exactly right. Most people, of course, are not going to use squigonometry in their daily life. In fact, trigonometry, probably a little bit less. Exploring things like squigonometry allows us to do is to do things like, for instance, be able to find areas and volumes in cases where we don't have a set formula. A lot of calculus, for instance, right? Many people don't use calculus on a daily basis, but they can lead to formulas for areas of really weird looking regions, and that's just based on, hey, we know the area of a rectangle. What if we overlay our weird region with a bunch of rectangles? I always think of, when I've had to move and we have to put in, a wood floor or something, you have to kind of overlay, figure out what the area is. You have to overlay, it with, of course, rectangular pieces of wood. And then you're trying to get it to fit into a weird region by making the width of the wood a little bit less and putting more in until it kind of, the shape kind of approaches what you want. And that's sort of what's going on here. It's just that for kind of the stranger objects like hyperellipses or super eggs, where we don't have things in trigonometry related to it. Now we have, at least for now, some of the tools we could use for that. You know, but it's kind of similar. I think of many times, sometimes with engineers, they don't do all the calculus right off the bat to do things. They have nice shortcut formulas. These are the types of, you know, types of formulas in trigonometry are probably the kind of things eventually somebody could come up with some nice shortcut formulas for them.
You gave that example earlier, Rob, of the town square. How did that concept find its way into Scandinavian architecture and furniture design?
Well, Pete Hein, after he did his amazing work on Serval's Tor, came up with this whole idea of, you know, rotating it and getting the super egg, and it tended to turn up in a lot of different places. Mathematicians were interested in them because of the fact that they didn't topple over if you put them on table. And for some reason, they just lent themselves to a lot of things like furniture design. So even today, if you go to the website named after Pete Hein, I think his family runs it, you can order, for instance, salt and pepper shakers in the shapes of super eggs. You can get little super eggs that are supposed to be stress relaxers. And so in the 60s, you could, for instance, go to a lot of homes and see tables where the tops were in the shapes of super ellipses, or sit on a bar stool where the cushion was in that sort of shape. So for whatever reason, the idea of these shapes and objects just really caught on in Scandinavia, and you can still order that type of furniture and those accoutrements today.
Hmm. Now, I know there's no squigonometry major at Norwich, but where does this fit into the instruction of mathematics at the school?
Well, I think part of our point, and certainly mine and Bill's, one of our purposes in writing the book was, one of the great things in mathematics is to be able to take concepts that are known pretty well, things that you just kind of internalize and say, well, what if we change this? In fact, Bill likes to tell the story that the way he came up with his initial article on squigonometry was he was teaching a class on that involved developing the trigonometric functions. And again, since it's on the circle, there were a lot of things with squares in them, with a exponents of two in them, and his class was underwhelmed. And so he said, just for the heck of it, let me change these exponents from a 2 to a 4, and all of these strange and beautiful things started just kind of emanating from continuing to work. So to be able to kind of take upperclassmen who have know their trigonometry, know their calculus pretty well, and say, well, you know what, we're going to change just this one small thing, seemingly small thing, and just have them see, well, in mathematics, things are so well intertwined that if you make one change over here, that's going to have large ripple effects that could just keep going across all of mathematics. So, for instance, changing that exponent from a 2 to a 4 makes changes to the trigonometric functions, but it also goes into things called hyperbolic functions and also makes changes to exponential functions and logarithms. So you get a lot of change just from making one small change, you know, in trigonometry.
Mm-hmm. Now, Rob, I read the piece you wrote, which was probably a few pages long. I hung with it all the way through, although I did not look at the calculations in depth. But when I read the summary at the end, I thought, okay, good. I have a decent grasp on this. But what can the two of you possibly fill an entire book with on this subject?
Well, the piece that I wrote a few years back, was about one thing, about developing, the different values of pi, for instance, and how making some of these changes, you know, allow us to, you know, to come up with, for instance, new ways to calculate some things in calculus and to be able to calculate these areas and volumes. In the book, what we do is we follow these ripples all the way through. So we look at all the things that you see in the article, but for instance, and we do have a chapter devoted to Pete Hine and his work, but we look at other things, for instance, for how might you approximate things like these new versions of pi, how do you look at alternate coordinate systems, what if you look at the exponentials and logarithms. Basically, the idea is we just take, we tell the readers what the changes are we're making at the beginning of the book, and we just follow from chapter to chapter one small change to show what the effects of it are. And, yeah, Bill was the one who said when we were on a Zoom conversation one day, this stuff just never stops giving. So
yeah,
it's a testament to how tightly connected all of mathematics is, that small changes in one place can just cause ripple effects across the entire fabric of mathematics.
I must admit that after this conversation, Rob, I will never hear Genesis's Ripples, which is on their Squonk album. It will never, or Trick of the Tail album, I'm sorry. Squonk is a song on there, but Trick of the Tail. Ripples will never sound the same to me again. Rob Pudiak is the chair of the Norwich University Mathematics Department and a co-author of a new book on squigonometry coming out later this year. Rob, I want to thank you so much for being on with us this morning.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the interest.
Yeah, fun with math. I loved it. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we'll return to learn about confusing fall warblers. And the Sox head out to the beautiful PNC Park to take on the Battle and Buccos of Pittsburgh. We're on the air at 6:05. The action gets started at 7:05. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group. We're more than just radio.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. So if the last segment on squigonometry left you a tad confused, you should do better. This half hour, as we discuss confusing fall warblers. Well, at least I think you'll be less confused. We're talking about them now because there is a Vermont Land Trust event in Brattleboro coming up in September that you can now register for. Here to explain about the confusing fall warblers is the Land Trust lead forester, Peter Van Loon. Peter, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Nice to be here.
We also have Corey Ross, the district manager of the Windham County Natural Resource Conservation District and a member of the Southeast Audubon. Corey, great to have you here as well.
Hi, Rick. Thanks.
Good morning. Now, listeners, if you have any questions about warblers, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Peter, give us a description of what a warbler is.
So a warbler is a small, what they call neotropical migrant. So it's a migrating songbird, and they're one of the more varied birds we have in the U.S. There are a number of different species, and a lot of them come through here in the east. They're often very brightly or boldly colored, and during the summer and then into the fall, some of them, not all, but some of them change their plumage, and those along with the immatures sort of start to blend together, and it can get a little confusing trying to figure out which is which.
What's not to love? A brightly colored songbird. But Peter, you use that term immatures. What is an immature warbler?
So an immature warbler is one that was born this year. So it's fledged, which means it's out of the nest and flying around and getting ready to head south.
Corey, Peter mentioned there are a lot of different warblers. How many different warblers do we tend to see in Vermont?
Well, that's a good question. I would say, I'm going to estimate, but maybe 10 to 14, depending on how lucky you are.
And they are migratory, so when do they show up here? When do they scram? When do we have them leave us?
Yeah, the first ones start to show up in late April or early May, but the big wave comes through a little bit later than that, maybe mid to late May. And some are already on the move now, but the largest movement will take place in early to mid-September, and they'll pretty much be all gone by the 1st of October.
Oh, wow. And where are they headed once they leave us here in Vermont?
So as Peter mentioned, they're neotropical migrants. A lot of them are headed to Caribbean islands or South America or Central America. A few do winter along like the Gulf Coast.
So no one's going to question their intelligence. They go to a nice, wonderful place once they get out of here. I'm going to ask you both this, but Peter, first, what do you think makes warblers particularly interesting?
I think people love them because of the bright colors, the fact that there are maybe, actually, it might be something in the way they move, too. They sort of bounce through the trees. Mm. But I think it's mostly about the bright, bold colors of things like a black-throated blue warbler or this brilliant blue and the Blackburnian warbler with its flame-orange throat. I think that's what draws a lot of people to warblers. What do you think, Corey?
And also they all have pretty distinctive songs that you can identify them by, and that's not always true. I mean, most birds, their songbirds have distinctive songs, but I feel like warbler songs are really distinctive, and you can learn them and memorize them.
Well, I'm not going to put either of you on the spot, but if one of you has a good warbler rendition, this is the time to say, hey, wait, I can do the warbler and give us one of their beautiful songs. Either of you, Peter, Corey?
I can give you the mnemonic device for a black-throated green warbler.
All right, good. We'll work with that.
Z-Z-Z-Z-Z.
And the black-throated blue is sort of a Z-Z-Z-Z. So another forester friend of mine who's into birds says he remembers the black-throated green warbler because its song goes up and down like the Green Mountains. Oh. And the black-throated blue warbler song just goes up like the sky.
Oh, why? Wonderful. That's a great way to remember that. Peter, when they're here in Vermont, where will we find them? Where do they tend to nest?
They're sort of all over the place. So there are things like the chestnut-sided warbler that will nest in more open areas, things like blue-winged and golden-winged warblers or shrubland birds. And then you get things like the black-throated blue warbler, which is in the lower parts of the forest, lower sort of shrubs in the forest or small trees. And then black-throated green warblers are up in the – and Blackburnians are up in the tops of trees. Mm. You'll find oven birds nesting on the ground. So they're kind of everywhere.
Yeah, they sure are. And what do they feed on, Peter?
Mostly insects. I'm not sure if they do much in the way of fruits and other things. What do you think, Corey?
Yeah, a number of them really like spider eggs. Mm-hmm. They'll glean off of, like, leaves and the underside of branches and things.
Now, Corey, the walk that's being scheduled by the Vermont Land Trust is going to be down your way, going to be in the Brattleboro area. So in your area, what are some particularly good places birders go to see warblers?
Yeah, so during migration, the Hinsdale setbacks in Hinsdale, New Hampshire, are probably the number one destination. Large movements of migrating warblers come through there in the spring and the fall. The West River Trail is a good spot in migration. And then during the summer months, while birds are on territory, a lot of our mountain environments are really good. Stratton Mountain comes to mind as a place where you can see some otherwise hard-to-find warblers like black pole warbler or magnolia warbler.
And if you're looking to bulk up your Vermont list and you don't want to go over to the Hinsdale setbacks, the Herrick's Cove area up around a little north of Bellows Falls is another great place.
Ah, fabulous. Thanks for that, Peter. Now, Corey, let's clear up some confusion right now. What are confusing fall warblers?
So a number of warbler species molt after they're done breeding. And so when they're trying to attract a mate, they want to look as brightly colored and beautiful as possible because the female's going to probably pick out the most attractive male to mate with. Mm-hmm. Once they're done mating, it doesn't really behoove them to be so brightly colored because that's hard to, you know, hide in the forest from predators. So they're going to molt into really drab coloring. So they're going to lose a lot of those bright, you know, reds and blues and greens. And they're going to be a lot of shades of gray and kind of dull yellow. And they sometimes have eye rings. They sometimes have wing bars. And so in order to identify them and tell them apart, you have to kind of know what to look for.
And you mentioned, so they aren't, you know, that well spotted by predators. So this is, you know, nature. It's part of the life cycle. Who are the predators for the warblers, Corey?
I would think small hawks, sharp-shinned hawks would be a pretty popular one around here, especially because the sharp-shinned hawks migrate south along with the warblers because they're following the food.
Mm. All right. Now, Peter, during the hike that you'll be conducting in September, what will you be focusing on?
So we'll be going through a bunch of different habitats, and we'll talk a little bit about those habitats as we go. So we'll start out in an area that's an old pasture that grew up into a lot of invasive plants, and we're controlling those and planting some native shrubs to try to create shrubland habitat for specifically blue-winged warbler, which had been there but had not been nesting. And then we'll walk up along a small stream, and we'll talk about things like water thrushes, which are technically warblers, and we'll then go up into a pine woods where we might see pine warblers or others who like a little higher canopy, and then we'll swing back down into the old pasture area.
Are there some warblers that we're worried about right now?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Peter just mentioned blue-winged warblers. There's a closely related relative of that, the golden-winged warbler, which is pretty sharply declining throughout its range. In fact, you'd be pretty lucky to see one anywhere around here. Also, the black-pole warbler that breeds in a lot of the alpine environments because of climate change. It's moving their environment up the mountain slope, and eventually they're going to run out of mountain slope to go up.
And, Peter, does one need to be a super experienced birder to keep up and enjoy on this outing that you're hosting in September?
No, absolutely not. If you're a beginner, you've never even done it before, come on along, and we'd love to have you. Corey will be there, and we're hoping we'll also have a few other people from Southern Vermont Audubon there to help people do the identification or to find birds and help other people see them in the trees or the shrubs. And, you know, one of the things, as Corey said, is you have to sort of key in on certain features, like whether it has an eye ring or whether it has wing bars, and that sort of thing. And so we'll all be, those of us who know a little bit about the birds and how to identify them, will be helping everybody else.
Peter, does this confusion only occur in the fall?
It's most pronounced in the fall, for sure. I mean, certainly during the summer months, there are a few that look fairly similar. But because you have the immatures with their new feathers, and you have the mature birds who have molted into their winter plumage, they all, or not all, but often, they start to sort of blend together.
And are there confusing fall warblers that aren't even warblers but get mistaken for them?
Well, there's one. If you look at Peterson's Confusing Fall Warblers section, they have a ruby-crowned kinglet in there, which looks a little bit like some of the warblers. The difference with that one is it's really tiny, and it's almost constantly on the move looking for food. So if you can tell it, but by its behavior, it's fairly simple to tell the difference.
Yeah, this is such an important thing. It's got its own section, so I love that, Corey. What are some telltale signs that people should be looking for when trying to identify, I guess, a true species of warbler from one of the confusing variety?
I mean, a really sharp pointed bill is probably one of the more diagnostic features of any warbler. And that's just, it's matched to their food group. If they're hunting insects, they need that sharp pointed bill. And then they're very small and they're very delicate. And so they stand out. And the only thing I ever sometimes confuse with warblers up in the canopy of a forest would be like a chickadee, which is also very small. But if you get a pretty good look, you know it's a chickadee, what it looks like.
All right. And now, what are the things you look for to make sure you can tell which warbler it is? You know, as these colors seem to be too close to quickly identify, you know, what are some other telltale signs to tell? Is this an immature warbler or is this a molting warbler?
So like Peter mentioned before, eye rings, like a lot of times you might only have, you know, 1 or 2 seconds to take in a bird before it moves quickly and you can't recite it.
Yeah.
So I'm usually looking to see, does it have an eye ring? Does it have wing bars, kind of like white bars on the wings? And then I want to look at under the tail, because some birds have really distinctive yellow under the tail that can really help identify that bird. If you get more time than that, you want to look at foot color, because black pole warblers have yellow feet, and sometimes that can be helpful.
And these things you mentioned, like the wing bars or the eyes, the circles around the eyes, are they of the immature variety? Are they of the mature variety? What can you tell?
That's different for different birds.
Of course. All right. And we got to go on this walk. Peter, do you still have a problem, you know, getting confused and identifying certain warblers at this time of year?
Oh, definitely. No question. Yeah. Corey and I were just talking about this. The Cape May warbler that comes through is a fairly regular visitor here in the fall. A little harder to see during the summer, but when it comes through, it looks a fair bit like a yellow-rumped warbler, so I struggle with that one a little bit. And the black pole warbler changes so much, it's always hard for me to sort of retrain my mind to look for something different, because during the summer, it's just all black and white, and in the fall, it's this drab, sort of greeny-yellow bird with brown sort of light streaks on it, and a couple of white wing bars, and it looks like a lot of different things.
Corey, any of that bedevil you that you want to mention?
You know, chestnut-sided, it makes a pretty bold transformation. But yeah, no, it's an equal challenge for me. I think it's a challenge for all birders. And that's part of the joy of birding is, you know, it never becomes old hat, no matter how long you do it. You get fresh challenges, and you get to kind of build your abilities as you go.
Are there any other birds, Corey, that have this kind of transformation that makes it so difficult for them to identify, or is this something with warblers that really is the more confusing than others?
This transformation happens in a number of birds that are migratory. Scarlet tanager, which of course is really black and red, the male is, becomes kind of a drab yellow. Orioles. Male orioles no longer look that way in the fall. So there's a little bit of confusion around, I guess, if you saw an immature scarlet tanager or Baltimore oriole or orchard oriole, you might need to get a good look. But there's just a few species under that classification, and there are, you know, so many warblers.
Now, Peter, for the outing you have coming up, do people need to register in advance?
We would appreciate it if they register in advance. Yes, please. And there's a spot for them to do it on our Vermont Land Trust website under the events tab.
Yeah, that is vlt.org/events is where you can go. Anything that would be helpful for people to bring along with them if they're going to join you that morning?
Yeah, definitely binoculars. That would be a good thing to bring if you've got them. It's going to be a fairly gentle walk. There isn't really any strenuous hills or anything like that. It probably will still be tick season, so to keep that in mind. We're going to do it if it's cloudy, or probably even if there's some light rain. But if it's really pouring, we're going to do it the following week. So come dressed for what will probably be a cool fall morning.
Corey, it has been encouraging to hear the two of you mention that this is still, you know, a bit difficult for you. But when did you get good at properly identifying these confusing fall warblers?
That's a good question. So, I mean, I've been a fairly serious birder for maybe 10 to 12 years. And after a couple of years of really going after it, I started to feel more proficient. I've also had some experience banding them, where you do catch them in a mist net and you band them, and I think that helps.
Yeah, you get to see them up a little closer, more personally. Peter, why is this an event that the Vermont Land Trust is involved with? You know, we think of the Land Trust of conserving land, but not always, having an outing quite like this. So,
yeah, so we've conserved a lot of land in Vermont, something like almost 10% of the state. And so we feel like we have a responsibility to help those landowners who have conserved their land and other folks who are out there making connections to the land to sort of understand what's out there and to help them be good stewards and connect them to the land. So any opportunity we get where we can do some sort of outreach and education for folks, we're looking for those. And this is a great opportunity because we're partnering with the Conservation District and Southeast Vermont Audubon. And we get to talk about a lot of different things besides just the birds. We can talk about the invasive plants and how that changed the habitat and why we're trying to control them to benefit the birds. And we can talk about there's too many deer on the property, and that's why in part there are too many invasive plants. And so there's a lot of different things that we can talk about and help people understand through the avenue of learning about birds, which a lot of people really love.
Corey, we've got about 30 seconds left. Can you tell us a little bit about the work of your conservation district?
Sure. So the conservation district's kind of main purpose is to connect landowners with the available resources of the state and federal government. So our goal is to be that bridge. And so we do river restoration projects. We support farmers with nutrient management planning assistance or helping them access state and federal money for conservation projects on their land. And we do a variety of outreach and education work, both in schools and to the public at large.
That's Corey Ross. He's the district manager of the Windham County Natural Resource Conservation District and a member of the Southeast Vermont Audubon. And we've also been speaking with Peter Van Loon, Vermont Land Trust lead forester. Thank you both so much for being on this morning.
Thanks, Rick.
You're welcome. And again, to learn more about the Confusing Fall Warblers, the walk, and to register for it, you can visit vlt.org/events. We're going to break for CBS News. Then we'll return to find out about the Inflation Reduction Act. And coming up today at 1, we've got 3 big hours of the getaway with the Danger Man, Danforth Cardozo. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. First, there was the proposed Build Back Better Act. It faced a tough slog in the Senate, but it has been pared down, and it's now known as the Inflation Reduction Act. It passed the House and the Senate, being signed into law today by President Joe Biden. It contains a lot of green initiatives, meaning further federal investments and incentives for renewables. So what might that mean for Vermont? Joining me to discuss just that is Peter Sterling, the Executive Director of Renewable Energy Vermont, or REV. Peter, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Always great to be here, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
Always great to have you. And also joining us is Eric Fanuff. He's the Vice President of Business Development of Aegis Renewable Energy in Waitsfield. Eric, welcome to you as well.
Thanks so much, Peter. Glad to be here.
Now, listeners, to ask our guests about the IRA, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Eric, since you have not been on the show before, please give us a little background on Aegis Renewable Energy.
Sure. Aegis Renewable Energy is located in Waitsfield, Vermont. We have about 12 employees, been in business for about 10 years, started doing small wind, and then quickly pivoted to solar when the wind market got very, very difficult. So we basically mostly do small utility scale systems and commercial size systems. So think of 150 kilowatts to 500 kilowatts in Vermont, which is basically maybe a half an acre to 3.5 acres of impact, and is the way someone would look at it out in a field.
All right. Now, Peter, looking at the Inflation Reduction Act, what is the law aimed at doing?
Before I get into the law is aimed at giving a boost to the wind and solar industries and battery storage industries around the country.
Mm-hmm.
But just to kind of set the table, here in Vermont for the last 6 years, we've really seen state government not only completely throttle our in-state wind industry, you know, the folks who are going out and are trying to get new renewables from the wind. We've also seen a pretty consistent decrease in support for our solar industry, which, you know, these folks like Eric and others are trying to get people to go green and go solar and get off of fossil fuels, but our state government has not been supporting that. So we've been kind of lagging behind other places, states in the country, particularly out west. So the Inflation Reduction Act is going to pump in about $369 billion in new spending over the next decade to help regular people get tax credits and businesses get tax credits to put more solar in, to do more wind, and importantly, to help people make the transition to electrify so many of the fossil fuel burning technology we use, like cars, and give people a tax credit for switching out that propane stove to an electric stove, which, you know, when people start making those individual decisions and they become more affordable, we could really make a big dent in decreasing the country's carbon emissions. I liken this to the impact of this bill, of this law, will be just as huge nationally as I think the passage of Social Security back in the 30s, the passage of Medicare by Lyndon Johnson, Great Society, back in the 60s, and the passage of the Affordable Care Act. It will finally bring the massive resources of the federal government to bear in moving us away from fossil fuels and toward a renewable energy economy.
Now, we knew that in Build Back Better, there were a lot of incentives as part of that for renewable energy. Have many of those incentives, Peter, made it into the IRA?
Oh, yeah, just at a slightly smaller scale. I mean, what is being passed is still an incredible achievement when you really think about it. Again, regular people around the country will finally be getting, you know, a tax break to help them afford to go get an electric car or get that new electric panel installed so they can electrify their house and get rid of the propane stove and the propane water heater and get an electric stove. And, you know, when we make that transition to renewable energy, which is important, we have to make sure that the electricity we're using for all these technologies isn't coming from fossil fuels, but it's actually coming from clean renewable energy like wind and solar.
Now, Eric, aside from the fact that your business obviously benefits whenever there are incentives for people to switch to renewable energy sources, what benefits do you see to Vermont and the environment from this new law?
So taking a cue from Peter in terms of putting this in the grand perspective of where our state of Vermont is in terms of incentivizing renewables versus where the federal government is incentivizing renewables, what this is going to do is going to help a little bit blunt the impact of the negative policy that's been taking place on rates in the net metering space anyway in Vermont. Just over the past 3 years, if you had permitted a project in September of 2019, your rate on a 150-kilowatt or residential-scale project up to 150 kilowatts would have been 17.4 cents. Today, if you permitted that project, it would be 15.4 cents. So that's a reduction in 14%. If you permitted a 500-kilowatt project, the reduction is 21.2%. So you can see the federal government has made a choice to go from a tax credit of 26% to 30% to increase the benefits, whereas Vermont is really going the other way. So all this is helping to do is potentially, you know, salvage some projects that weren't going to pencil out before. We're hopeful that Vermont, and we're trying to get the PUC to sort of change course and really recognize the full societal costs and benefits of solar to Vermont, not only jobs and the environment itself, but the greenness of our electricity as we electrify has to be renewable. And right now, as much as, you know, the claims of the larger utilities will want you to believe, It's how we've defined renewable, which allows them to claim that, and it's not really truly, you know, new solar and wind. It's largely based on, you know, hydro and nuclear, and it's old, and it doesn't really move the needle at all.
Mm. Now, Peter, are there any items that are missing from this act that you were hoping would be included?
Not really. I think it's just a question of scale, the difference mm-hmm. between the Build Back Better proposal versus the Inflation Reduction Act just had more money. I will tell you, one of the things that is interesting when you peel back the curtain is what got the wind and solar industry really from a kind of a birth industry to a much more mature industry is when the tax credits happened. Right. That allowed consumers and businesses to actually get a rebate for the upfront cost of renewables. And that was going away before the Inflation Reduction Act happened. And right now, so if you're a consumer, as Eric was kind of hinting at, the price of installing renewables has gone up because state compensation has decreased. That 15%, that went to the consumer. Now with the Inflation Reduction Act increasing that tax credit to 30%, as a consumer, you can really make that choice to go solar. But what's also happened, and this is a really interesting thing that's kind of unique to Vermont, if I can explain it in a quick minute.
Sure.
We obviously, solar panels generate power during the day. And we do actually a pretty good job of generating power here in Vermont from solar during the day. However, when we need power at night, we have to go to the grid from the New England grid, which, as Eric alluded to, has a lot of dirty power, most including nuclear. It gets really hot or really cold, coal and oil, which most Vermonters probably are not aware that when they turn on the light or charge their iPhone, they are using coal or oil if it's really hot or really cold. The IRA, for the first time ever, is a tax credit for battery storage. And this is a game changer, an absolute game changer for Vermont. Because if you can start pairing all the good solar you have in Vermont with some storage for it, so instead of sending it back to the grid when you have extra solar power generated on our nice sunny days, you can now store it and use it at night. Vermonters can now be using solar power at night from these batteries instead of going back into the grid to take nuclear and coal and oil power. So if we could really get a real storage program going here in Vermont to soak up all the good solar that we're using and increase the deployment of more solar, we could be completely changing the nature of how and where we get our energy from. And like Eric said, we just need our state government and our public utility commission to go along with that. We could really be moving much faster toward a renewable energy future.
And Peter, as people have been watching this, there have been two holdout Democrats, Senators Sinema and Manchin, Senator Joe Manchin from a coal-producing state. So what did get them on board with the Inflation Reduction Act?
Well, I'm not an expert in West Virginia politics or Arizona politics, but from what my gathering was, they saw how much business would actually be coming to their states in the form of domestic solar production. And the IRA also had big tax credits for the actual production of solar equipment. Most of the equipment we have now comes from either Southeast Asia or China, you know, the panels and the inverters, the other things that connect the solar power you on your roof to the grid and all that stuff. But the domestic manufacturing tax credits, they saw that come into their state. They saw the value of the power that could be generated in their state, what that would mean for jobs in their state. I think that's what it ultimately came down to, was economics. They saw the future, especially in Arizona, where, you know, the potential for solar is almost unlimited.
Yeah. Eric.
I can shed, if you
yeah, please.
Step back, Peter, I can shed some light on that West Virginia politics question.
Great.
So Joe Manchin, one big thing he got out of this was there will be no new leases for solar for federal lands unless there is also a gas or oil lease offered. So he basically made sure that federal lands would be open to continued solar and gas exploration. I mean, gas and oil exploration. So that was one issue that was big for him. Another one is there's a big pipeline, a natural gas pipeline that is trying to get permitted in West Virginia. And while it wasn't included in the act, from what I understand, there's been some, you know, assurances that permitting process will go more smoothly than it otherwise would have. And then Peter alluded to the benefits and incentives for domestic production, and I believe there are some companies who are promising to, you know, create some jobs and do some actual equipment production in his state of West Virginia.
Gotcha. Thanks, Eric. Peter, I was there in the 70s and 80s when gas prices shot up, and we talked a lot about renewables then. Now, granted, the technology was probably different then compared to now, but had we made a commitment like this, like the IRA, then where might we be today when it comes to our dependence on fossil fuels?
Wow. You know, that's the $64,000 question right there. You know, I don't think back in the 70s we had the specter of climate change pushing policymakers to make this kind of investment. I think it really took literally icebergs melting, you know, massive floods and storms everywhere for people to really understand that this investment is important. But just this perspective, you know, you said we have about $370 billion to spend in new spending from this Inflation Reduction Act. It may sound like a lot, but as perspective, the Afghanistan war, and I'm not saying whether it was right or wrong, right?
Sure.
That was $2.3 trillion. For me, the question really is what if we had spent a bunch of that money from the Afghan war on investing in more renewable energy so we don't have, you know, the impacts of climate change? And so I'm grateful that, you know, the U.S. Congress has went in the right direction. I also got to say, our neighboring state to the south, Massachusetts, which has a Republican governor and a Democratic legislature, you know, their governor, Charlie Baker, decided to work with the Democrats in the power of the legislature to pass, you know, a climate bill that really moved in the right direction. You know, we here in Vermont for the last 6 years have not moved in the right direction. We've moved backwards, as Eric has said, you know, eliminating the ability to deploy new wind resources, reducing the amount of money Vermonters can get when they decide to go solar. We need to start moving in that right direction. The Global Warming Solutions Act, which passed a couple years ago, you know, set us on a track to study the problems, but we haven't actually put our money where our mouth is and moved in an aggressive direction like Massachusetts and the Congress have toward helping Vermonters get off of fossil fuels and get onto renewable energy by electrifying their vehicles, how they heat and cool their homes, you know, their stoves when they cook, things like that.
Eric, we've heard a lot about supply chain issues and specific to your industry, your business, is availability of solar panels. How have things been for you at Aegis as far as getting the solar panels you need for the projects you're working on?
It's been very difficult in the past 12 months for a number of reasons. You know, COVID supply chain issues have been one, but then there have been some specific tariff issues that made things extremely difficult. And there was a sort of a anti-dumping case, I guess is what you would call it, that thank God the Biden administration sort of shelved the proceeding for 2 years. So those tariffs got removed, but they were in place for 6 months. And these are, you know, the cues in the commercial market like that in a global supply chain, they have long-term effects. It just doesn't change on a dime. So we had about a seven-month hiccup with a radical increase in prices in panels and not even having panels because the company simply wouldn't ship them because they were afraid that once they got here, they would be retroactively subject to this exorbitant penalty.
Yeah.
So that has cleared, but the supply chain hasn't sort of caught up to the clearing. So we anticipate in the next, you know, probably Q2 2023, panel supply to be a little bit, you know, better than it has been, but stability in markets is really important. And you asked a question to Peter about what would have happened had we made this investment, you know, back in the 70s. On a global scale, we would have more stability in energy prices, as we can see with the war. I mean, fossil fuels, it's a volatile, it comes from volatile places in the world. And just aside from their environmental impacts, which I think is atrocious, but just let's talk about the finances. It's super variable. And with solar, your upfront cost is known, and over time, there's no incremental cost to the fuel. There just isn't. So, you know, you've got to suck it up and make an investment in the beginning, but then you have stability over the long term, which is really good for economies in general. So I really hope that we start to get there. And this is a small down payment by the federal government in moving us in that direction. But you know, the states have to do their parts too, and our New England neighbors are doing it, and Vermont's not, and it's very discouraging from my perspective.
I'd like to hear both your thoughts on this, and I'll start with you, Peter. Where do you see this act, the IRA, having the greatest impact on the state of Vermont when it comes to renewable energy?
That's a really good question. Well, I think the biggest impact will be helping consumers make choices that right now, like Eric said, require some upfront investment. And that, but in the long term payoff, like I have an electric car, it costs a little more upfront, but right now I'm paying the equivalent of $1 a gallon of gas. I mean, that's a payback every day for me. So to help more Vermonters afford renewable energy, help more Vermonters get into an electric vehicle. Those are things that put real money in people's pockets, right? What Eric was alluding to is, you know, renewable energy is anti-inflationary because your costs are fixed once you buy your solar array or buy into that. And that's right now the main thing causing inflation are fossil fuels. So if you could imagine not having being as reliant on fossil fuels, we'd be seeing less inflation. That would help Vermonters every day in their pocketbook. So when you're able to switch off that propane stove or natural gas stove, get onto an electric stove and having it run on renewable energy, which is not that hard to do once you get past the upfront cost, you know, you're going to be saving yourself a lot of money down the road, and Vermonters will be less, like Eric said, tethered to a war in Iraq or a war in Ukraine or some other, you know, big problem with shipping us power from fossil fuels. It's a big deal to Vermonters in their pocketbooks, I think.
Yeah. Eric, same question to you. Greatest impact this bill will have on the state of Vermont?
Two big impacts. One, it's going to the trickle of projects that has been reducing due to the reduction in the rates, I think it will sort of stabilize that a little bit, right? It's not going to accelerate the pace of development, but I think it may stem the retrenchment a bit. But I'm hopeful that the biggest thing is that our state legislature is going to see that the federal government is leading by example, and they are going to take this as another sign that they really need to address that in this legislative session. And that would be the biggest thing, honestly.
Peter Sterling, solar, wind, hydro, nuclear, methane digesting, these are where we're turning for renewable sources. But is there any other renewable energy source that is on the horizon that might be added to this mix eventually that will have us move further away from fossil fuels?
Well, it may sound like science fiction, but then again, if you ever asked me 30 years ago that I have this little phone in my hand that could be more powerful than any computer I've ever imagined, I never would imagine what an iPhone could do. There's a technology on the horizon about hydrogen, about, you know, using electricity to create more electricity from hydrogen, and its only output would be water, you know, so that could be an amazing technology. There's a lot that I would have to break right for it to become economically feasible, but certainly if folks want to Google, you know, hydrogen power, green hydrogen, they might find some interesting reading about what the future could hold there.
And Eric, how encouraged are you about the IRA?
I think it's great. It is so much better than the alternative. And from a federal government perspective, I think it's good. You know, I give it, from a solar perspective, it's not an A+, but it's definitely a B, and it's way better than the D that we were going to get with nothing. So I think it's a really good thing.
Yeah. Peter, early on in this conversation, you mentioned wind and how the state of Vermont has, you know, really pulled back, kind of scuppered any wind developments going on in the state. What caused that? How can that get restarted? I drive in some areas of the state, I see those big turbines, and I think, boy, this is fabulous.
It's just politics. It's a policy choice by Governor Phil Scott to, you know, not allow wind to move forward. The Public Utility Commission, which regulates all energy in Vermont, enacted the strictest wind sound rule in the nation, 42 decibels. 42 decibels, for folks out there, is about the sound you would make talking low in a library. And, you know, when you're talking, everything we do pretty much to generate power has impact. Nuclear power has impact. Natural gas has impact, you know, burning coal and oil. So
yes, there's something, there's an impact with everything. To me, just a little bit of noise from all the clean energy that could be developed by wind, and that wind blows pretty hard here in Vermont at night, making a perfect complement to solar. All we would need is the governor and the legislature to direct the Public Utility Commission to simply not have the strictest wind sound rule in the country, come up with a reasonable rule that reasonable people could agree with, and then we can get back to generating, you know, power for thousands and thousands and thousands of homes from just, you know, a handful of wind turbines in Vermont. It would really be an incredible thing to get us off fossil fuels. Mm. And let me just say one last thing about the wind power, which goes to the bigger picture.
Very quickly.
There are so many people in Vermont who have that not in my backyard approach. They only want Vermont to be a park. We are a working landscape. We support logging. We support extractive industries like the granite industry. We have farms. We should not be asking people in Canada to live near dams and people to live near nuclear power plants in New Hampshire and coal and oil plants in Connecticut and Massachusetts to generate our power. We have to understand there are impacts to the power we want, and we should have to live with some of those impacts, which includes looking at a wind turbine every now and then.
That's Peter Sterling, Executive Director of Renewable Energy Vermont. Eric Faniff is the VP of Business Development at Aegis Renewable Energy in Waitsfield. And to learn more, you can visit revermont.org. Peter, Eric, thank you so much for the time this morning.
Great question on the issue, Peter.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break and then return. We're going to visit Vermont's only mattress recycling center. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. When I mentioned the idea of a mattress recycling center to friends, they were intrigued and hesitant. Can it be done? Is it safe? Who's doing this? Questions they asked. Great questions, and ones we'll have answered in the next half hour. Joining me now from Sleepwell Recycling, Vermont's only mattress recycling center, is founder Josh Costa. Josh, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
It's great to have you. Listeners, to ask Josh a question or share a comment, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-TALK, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Josh, what exactly is Sleepwell Recycling?
Yeah, so we are a mattress and box spring recycling facility. So pretty much all that means is we break down mattresses and box springs to their basic parts and recycle the contents that we can. So things like the metal springs, the foam, memory foam, toppers, so the top piece of the mattress that has the textile and then some foam underneath, the wood of the box spring, and another piece that's in between the foam and the coils called shoddy, which is like kind of a gray conglomerate material that's also recyclable. Mm. And so we strip it all down and into those basic parts and ship them off where we need to ship them to be recycled.
So you're not cleaning these up and selling them off to somebody else?
No, we don't do any resale. We would love to donate, as we do get a lot of great mattresses, but since COVID, and it's always been difficult to donate mattresses. Mm-hmm. But it's even harder nowadays, so we just rip them up and recycle the contents that we can. Yep.
Now, Josh, were you wide awake, or did the idea for this come to you in a dream?
Good question. You know, if you talk to my mom, she'll tell you that since I was 2 years old, I always wanted to be a garbage man. And so I'm living the dream here, Rick. I've been doing this. My first job when I was 15, I was in a precious metal refinery down in Nashua, New Hampshire, taking apart computers and TV monitors and giant servers and sorting them into their basic parts. And then eventually they grind down all the plastic and smelt it or whatever they do and get to the precious metals. So from there, I came to college in Champlain, Champlain College, and started working at 1-800-GOT-JUNK, the junk removal company. Right. That's a national company. And I kind of ran that business for multiple years and then got into hazardous waste and did a little moonlighting on the side doing junk removal for college kids in the springtime, and I just was blown away by the amount of mattresses that I was seeing. Yeah. And since Vermont has one landfill, we are very careful not to fill it up. And if we are filling it up with bulky items, they make sure to charge you for that space that you're taking up. So getting rid of a mattress in the state of Vermont, I mean, the minimum seems to be right around $20 per mattress. And so I was thinking to myself, hey, could I undercut this and maybe recycle the contents if there's a way to sell this foam and sell this metal and all the other components? And sure enough, there were some people looking to buy foam, people looking to get rid of their mattresses cheaper and obviously have them be recycled.
Mm. When did the business get up and running, Josh?
We started in August 1st of 2020, so mid-pandemic. I don't know if we're still in it or not, but that was kind of the heyday for the pandemic. And where I was working, doing hazardous waste at the time, we were kind of doing a half routine there. We weren't full strength. And so I just thought, hey, might as well see if I can start something up. And I was lucky enough to have my brother who's in college. He was doing remote college for that portion of time in the fall of 2020. So I said, hey, you want to ship up here and live with me and help me start this business? You can do your classes from the warehouse. And he bit, and that's how we got started, just a box cutter and some in a warehouse.
I love it. I was going to ask you what you needed to get off the ground. There you go. Very simple.
Yeah. Yep.
Where do you get your mattresses from?
Absolutely. So obviously the residential portion of our business is quite strong, but unbeknownst to me before starting this business, how willing a lot of other businesses would be and how many mattresses some business do get. So we're collecting mattresses from a lot of municipalities. So obviously here in Chittenden County, Northwest, up in the St. Albans, Georgia area. And we also do hotels, universities, furniture stores. Those are some of our biggest suppliers, and then obviously the residential.
And people pay you to take them, right? So how much will they pay you?
Yes. So we charge $20 to $30, depending on the size, per mattress, which is the going rate. So normally if you bring it to your town dump or bring it to garbage, whatever big garbage dump you go to, they'll charge you, and they call it a bulky item fee, just because of the space that these things take up. So bulky items are things like furniture, like mattresses, box springs, couches, recliners, love seats, all this kind of stuff that they don't really break down too well. And if they try to smash it with their bulldozer to get it into the load, go into the dump, doesn't work too well. And so it's just a really bulky item. So what they say in the mattress recycling business is one mattress takes up a metric tons worth of space. So that's one mattress taking up what could be a ton's worth of compacted garbage.
Wow.
And so, we pretty much just divert as much of that volume, up to 90% of that mattress, from the landfill. So what's going to the landfill could fit in a shopping bag or something smaller. So we're really sucking out all the bulky items, bits of these materials, and sending them to a place where they can be either recycled or repurposed.
And what types do you take? Standard mattresses with springs, box springs?
Oh, yeah.
The newfangled
all-foam
rolled up in a box mattresses? You take all these things?
Exactly. So the thing about the mattress in a box, those are all foam.
Yeah.
So they're condensed down to fit into the box, and then when you open them up, they spring open, and they're never going to be that small again.
No.
So what we do is we obviously take off the fabric around it, which is what we call the topper, and then underneath is just a big old we call them cheese slices in the business, just a big old chunk of foam. And we saw that up and to a size of where we can put it in our baler and compress it and fit it with all the other foam.
Mm. And
any mattress.
About how many in a typical day, how many mattresses are you taking in and processing there at your facility?
Yeah, I'd say, there's obviously a season for this. During the springtime, we hit our peak during college move-out seasons,
right.
Spring cleaning, all that kind of stuff. So earlier this May, all through May and June, we were collecting close to 75, 80 mattresses a day.
Wow.
And I think our standard would be right around 40 to 50.
And how many people are working there for you, Josh?
Well, we're a pretty small crew. I've got two guys. I got myself, my brother who was up here for the summer, and myself, pretty much.
So you're working hard handling that many mattresses. All right, so a mattress comes in. Where do we start? How do we dismantle this thing?
Yeah, so basically it's a pretty easy process, but it just requires a lot of elbow grease. So we take in the mattress, and I'm picturing my warehouse with close to 75 mattresses in it already. So I take my pick, you know. I kind of have an idea of which ones are going to be the quickest to go at and which ones will take me about 10 minutes. But we take a box cutter, we cut around the mattress, and take off the topper and throw that on a stack of rest of the toppers, and then underneath that would probably be a metal coil, and we take that out, bring it over to our metal bin filled with metal already. All the metal springs go in there, and that's pretty much it. It takes about 7 minutes per mattress on average is kind of how we're clocking it, and then the box springs are much easier because there's no foam in there most of the time, so all we have to do with the box springs is take the fabric off, and then underneath that is the metal with wood slats going across it. And we just recently built a little machine, kind of like a hydraulic machine, to push that metal of the box springs off of the wood, which has been saving us close to 10 minutes per box spring. We used to do it with a sledgehammer, hitting the wood off the metal with a sledgehammer, but now we've got that down to a science, and we're doing about 30 seconds of that box spring.
Oh, that's brilliant. Now, Josh, want to check on this because this could be, you know, an industry problem, but, you know, one reason people are loath to take someone else's mattress or box spring are bed bugs. So before you start working on it, do you have to check for anything like that?
Yeah, when we take in a mattress, we give it a once over. They have pretty clear defined signs if that kind of activity is going on. Mm-hmm. But up here in Vermont, I hear that the bed bugs, they don't really like inclement weather. They don't like changes of seasons as much. And so, honestly, we've dealt with a few mattresses that have had that. But honestly, from the majority, I think we're pretty safe. And if you do some research on bed bugs, they're pretty docile creatures when they're not at your house.
Gotcha.
They don't like to be on clothes. They don't like to go for rides in the car or whatever else like that. So we take our precautions. We make sure we change our clothes after our shifts and whatever else like that. But we haven't run into anything like that. Knock on wood here.
Yeah.
But
it is definitely
something that we think about we definitely take the measures to mitigate that risk. But, you know, over the last 2 years, over 10,000 mattresses down, we've probably only quarantined about 12 mattresses out of over 10,000.
Very interesting. And with all the dust mites, do you worry about that? And I dare say it, since we've all had enough of them, but do you wear masks to kind of protect yourself?
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah. We do often wear masks when we're ripping and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, there's, you know, quite a few mattresses nowadays, the bed in the box, they have a lining, a flame retardant lining with fiberglass in it.
Mm.
And so we're very cautious of those type of mattresses. And, you know, there's always a surprise. And as far as even taking these things apart and trying to recycle the pieces, you know, we really don't know much about what's going on with these mattresses. So, yeah, we do take every precaution as far as our breathing and you know, skin contact and all that kind of stuff. So a lot of long sleeves on hot days and a lot of masks on hot days as well.
Josh, before we get back to the mattresses, I want to talk hoops with you. Now, you went to a college, I believe, Champlain College, that has no basketball team.
Right.
But you've had a basketball career. Am I right about this?
Yeah. That was so funny. You're definitely referencing the 7 Days article, which my whole family and friends were elated to tell me that finally my basketball career in Southeast Asia is now on wax. It's it's written about, and now it makes it ultimately true. So, yeah, just to go over that real quick. So I went to Southeast Asia. My girlfriend got a job in out west in Oregon after college, and we were both kind of figuring out what the next step was. And I had just finished with 1-800-GOT-JUNK here in Burlington, and took a flight out to Oregon to visit my girlfriend, and ended up keep going. I went to Southeast Asia, started in Hanoi, Vietnam, and with the goal of playing basketball every day, and wanted to see what I could do. And like you said, I went to Champlain, where there was no real collegiate basketball team, so we played intramurals and won championships, and I was looking for a little bit more competitiveness in my life. I was a late bloomer, Rick. I didn't grow into my body until I was about 23 and a half, so I wanted to get out there and show my stuff. So I traveled from the north of Vietnam down to the south by motorbike looking for basketball hoops. And once I got down to Ho Chi Minh City, formerly Saigon, I started playing every day. And eventually from one league to the next league, I'd get invited to another group that was playing on Tuesday nights, and eventually ended up playing and scrimmaging with the Vietnamese national team for a couple months, which was a dream come true. To get in there and show my stuff with some of the greatest athletes of that area of the world. Yeah, it was a dream come true for me, and I look back on those times very fondly, all the competition and motorcycle riding and whatnot.
I don't know what the greatest thing is you've done in your life. This this mattress recycling is phenomenal, but the basketball story is great too. You got to write the book. All right, let's talk about what's going on here, because you've got this outward supply chain. Let's talk about the fabric, that covers the mattress. Where does that go? Yeah. What's it used for?
Yeah, so this is called a topper, and so most of the textiles on the side and back of a one-sided mattress is not usable. So we get rid of the textiles that have no foam on the inside of them. So if there's a topper on the top of your mattress with foam and textile around it, that is what we call a topper, and that is baled by a compactor that we have and shipped down to a place called GMR in New Jersey, and they turn it into carpet underlay. So the speckled, all of our foam goes down to this place, and they turn it into carpet underlay, which is the speckled carpeting stuff underneath your carpet.
Yeah, okay. Oh, I like that. Next, the wood frames, the wood you're knocking out there. Yep. You now have the machine that does
Absolutely.
It. Where does that
yep.
go?
So we're right by the Intervale in Burlington, and right up the Intervale is the McNeil Wood Waste Plant. And so they're burning all this clean wood from businesses, residents, wherever they can get their wood. And so we bring it on down there, and it's burnt for energy.
All right. Next is the metal from the springs.
Yep.
So that's a big piece once you
Yeah. So that's a lot of volume. So like we were saying with the volume of the mattresses, the amount that they take up. So we fill up these 40-yard dumpsters with our metal frames and coils. So we fit about 60 to 80 metal coils or mattress coils into these boxes. And then a local metal recycler comes in, picks them up, drops it off at their facility, crushes it down, and brings it where it needs to go to be smelted down back into steel.
Oh, my gosh. And that 40-foot dumpster, that's your big boy. So,
yeah, they fill up quick. And that's my favorite part of the business is the volume, keeping the volume out of that landfill. So when you see one of those, we turn out about three of those dumpsters filled with metal a week. So when we see those going goodbye to be smelted down and turned back into some type of metal, that's really a good feeling for us, because when you see that size of something and think about it in the ground, in the landfill, and we just sucked it out and kept it out of there, it is a really nice feeling. Because just a real quick talk about the landfill here in Vermont. So we only have one, and yeah, it was extended in 2019, which means we needed more space. And because we're such an environmentally conscious state here, it's really difficult to start another landfill. I don't think that we necessarily want another landfill.
Right.
So to me, that space, putting the right things into that space in the landfill is so important. And I think that the fact that mattresses are so divertible, it just takes a lot of work and it's pretty nasty work and whatever else. But the amount of space that we're saving that could be filled with the things that deserve to go to the landfill, that's our true mission. And watching that metal go by is a good feeling for us because it's a lot of volume.
You're about 2 years into this, Josh. So do you have plans to expand elsewhere in the state or even franchise this idea?
Yeah, so we're definitely getting to the point where we want to extend our reach. We haven't gotten down to central Vermont where you guys are at yet, and even farther south. We'd love to get down to, you know, the White River type area. Mm-hmm. But lugging mattresses, it's pretty tough. You can't fit too many in a truck. You can't fit too many in an 18-wheeler. You could probably fit 100 or so. So it's kind of more or less trying to figure out how we how we traverse that kind of transport. And so some of our ideas are maybe we could start having collection days at certain communities. We go down to Montpelier and have a collection day, and people can come bring their mattresses and have them be recycled.
Ah, genius. I don't mean to get personal, but what kind of mattress do you sleep on?
You know, I've been in the junk game for so, in the garbage game and junk game for so long that everything I have is old and worn out, and that's just kind of how I like it. I like everything with a story. So my mattress is the same mattress that I first bought when I came up to college.
Oh, nice.
So it's about 14 years old, and we do get a lot of nice ones, and I've been, me and the girlfriend been thinking about finding a new one, but nah, not yet.
Well done. Josh Costa is the founder of Sleep Well Recycling in Burlington. You can learn more at sleepwellrecycling.com. Josh, it was great learning all about what you're doing at Sleep Well and your great basketball career. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
It's been our pleasure. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Feel free to suggest guests or topics by emailing vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint and subscribe to the podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we go ballooning, when we learn about farm to cheese, and we visit the Big Picture Farm in Townsend.